What's your take on what's happening right now? We've learned from Iranian sources. It seems that they have Iranian media published a map on Israel that everybody, all these planes going to Israel. What's going on in Israel? Are we going to see new attacks on Iran?
I believe we're headed in that direction. I think what we see right now is a master plan that's been embraced by both Israel and the United States that's focused on regime change, using the Iranian nuclear program as a justification for this regime change. But it's the American approach to regime change is long term. Look at the Iraq. It took a decade or more to get rid of Saddam Hussein from 1990 to 2003. Syria was a multi-generational, 20-plus year program of regime change. Iran has been under sanctions for some time now. This Israeli-U.S. attack has set Iran's nuclear program back, hasn't eliminated it though, which I think was by intent, because now it's what I call the inspection trap. It's the same, way that the United States trapped Iraq with weapons of mass destruction, trapped Syria with chemical weapons. Even though Syria gave up its chemical weapons in 2014, 2015, under OPCW inspections, the United States and the West continue to make allegations of Syria cheating, holding on. And right now you see the same play being done. The IAEA has to be allowed back in. Iran won't, and that's deliberate. This was a deliberate setup by the IAEA to make themselves unwanted in Iran. So, what happens when you don't have inspectors on the ground in an incompletely destroyed or not destroyed at all nuclear program? It allows people to say, oh, they're pursuing a nuclear weapons program. We have to keep the sanctions in place. We have to keep, the pressure on. And it could lead to a situation where you have periodic exchanges of a bombing designed to destroy the social fabric of Iran and bring down the Iranian government, which is the objective of the United States and Israel. It's never really been about the nuclear program, because I think the West understands there never was a nuclear weapons program, and I don't believe Iran is going to be pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Just like, after a couple years, Saddam gave up and any, desire of having weapons of mass destruction, but we continue to say, oh, he has them, they're secreting. Syria gave up their chemical weapons, but they had them, they were secret. Iran doesn't want a nuclear weapons program, but they have a nuclear program now that's not being inspected by inspectors, so therefore we believe they have nuclear. I just think that this is what we're looking at now. It's a variation of a theme that succeeded in Iraq and in Syria, and Israel and the United States believes it will succeed in Iran as well.
I think that in the aftermath of during the attack on Iran, we've learned what I was surprised because I saw how the Iranian society has changed. I haven't seen this, Scott, before since the I learned about I read about it in the aftermath of during the war with Iraq. And even the people who are in the West, who are outside Iran, they ha somehow criticize the government, the system, and all of this. They're supporting the government. They're supporting Iranian people. And I don't see Iran giving up with these sort of pressures. Do you feel that Donald Trump would understand that if they go to war, it can take a decade, in my opinion, and they're not gonna win because Iran is different. I don't know how much of this sort of understanding is acceptable for the administration.
In order for an understand something to be comprehended or understood, there has to be knowledge. And I don't believe there's anybody in the Trump administration that has genuine knowledge of Iran. Well, we have intelligence operatives who are able to identify weaknesses in the Iranian structure, but these are standard weaknesses you get anywhere. People like to drink. People you know, have sex outside of their marriage. People need money. All of these things are, you know, human foibles that are vulnerabilities that are exploited by intelligence services for blackmail, for greed, etc. And, you know, Iran has shown that it is susceptible to this as well. You know, the Mossad and CIA have preyed upon, you know, Iran's need for and use of foreign workers, and exploited these, you know, the pipeline that's gone in to infiltrate people into Iran. There are people in the Iranian society that, for whatever reason, have become, you know, fallen under the control of the Mossad and the CIA. And so, you know, they can exploit the lapses in patriotism, I guess you could call it. But that doesn't mean that Iran is failing or that it's a weak society ready to collapse. In fact, I think, as you said, the evidence shows that Iran is coming together even stronger. You know, the other thing that's different is that, unlike Iraq, Iran hasn't lost a war. If anybody thinks Iran lost this 12-day war, they aren't taking a look. You mentioned this map of this place is struck. You know, Israel today won't allow anybody to truly investigate what happened at the sites that were struck by Iran. I guess the Channel 13 in Israel is talking about, you know, massive damage and massive casualties. I don't know if that's true. It'd be difficult for Israel to hide that many deaths. I believe that there would have to be, under the Jewish faith, you know, funerals within a certain period of time. But, you know, the fact is significantly more, you know, targets were hit by Iranian missiles, a much greater number than's being declared by the Israelis, who are trying to, you know, paint the perception of success. And so, you know, Iran is not a defeated nation, and that's sort of the difference. The other thing, both Iraq and Syria, and I don't mean to insult any Iraqis or Syrians, but they were artificial nations, literally carved out of the Ottoman Empire by, you know, France and Great Britain at the end of World War I, sustained for some time with monarchies that weren't, you know, that were imposed on a disparate people who had nothing in common. I mean, Saddam Hussein's, you know, greatest challenge was how to create an Iraqi national identity from Shia, Sunni, Kurds. How do you bring these disparate peoples together? And it was almost a mission impossible for him. Iran is an ancient land. You know, Persian culture goes back, you know, more than three millennia. Even more, there's just a difference here that, you know, Iran is a nation that's not going to bend the knee, is not going to yield. They haven't been defeated. And I think that there's certain expectations, from the Trump administration, from the Israeli government, that aren't going to be met. Understand this too. Trump has a little more than 3 years left. It took over a decade, as I said, to get rid of Saddam after defeating him in the Gulf War. It took more than two decades to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. You know, and this is after a major civil war, or foreign-induced civil conflict, that almost defeated him. The Russians had to intervene in 2015 to save him. Iran hasn't been defeated. In fact, Iran has punched back very hard against Israel, and Iran still has the ability to intimidate the United States. If you don't think what happened at Al Udeid Air Base wasn't an act of Iranian intimidation, meaning that the United States was purposely trying to avoid major retaliation. You know, never once did Iraq have that kind of leverage over the United States. Never once did Syria have that kind of leverage over the United States. Iran continues to enjoy that leverage over the United States, and to an extent, Israel. Israel's not yearning to be you know, once again become a target of, you know, Iran's ballistic missiles. So I think that, you know, altogether, you know, the United States and Israel are trying to superimpose a template that may have worked in Iraq, may have worked in Syria, but more likely than not is not going to work in Iran.
Do you, when they're talking about attacking Iran, I would wonder, what do they want to achieve? In their first attack, in my opinion, it was all about the regime change. You see the decapitation, you see the way that they were bombing with drones and all of these nuclear facilities. They used fighter jets for nuclear facilities. They targeted the Iranian scientists. But the main goal was the decapitation and bring some sort of chaos in Iran. I don't see that coming with any further attacks on Iran. And I don't see that Israel would be able to defeat Iran on in a war of attrition. Here comes the United States. The United States comes to the scene. And how do they want to be? Do they want to continue? Do they want to fight a war on behalf of Israel, which we know that the United States with the bases in the Middle East, in the Arab states, they're not capable of using those bases. They're going to be targeted easily. They're going to use Diego Garcia, which is defenseless. We know that the air defense system is not that good for Diego Garcia, and Iran can reach it. How is that going? Because you have to bring all these elements in your decision making. How do you find that?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that the Trump administration has yielded the floor to Israeli intelligence, meaning that the CIA and other intelligence organizations that normally provide the foundational analysis on Iran and, you know, how things could play out have been pushed to the side, and it's Israel that's come forward. And we also know that Israel's intelligence, sometime around 2000, 2001, gave up on, if you remember, you know, I say if you remember, I don't even know when you were born, but 1973, Yom Kippur War. It was a major intelligence failure on the part of Israel, not on the part of Amman or even Mossad, both of whom detected evidence of Egypt making preparations to cross the Suez Canal and reported it up the chain of command. Not on the part of the IDF, whose frontline forces were reporting suspicious activity, things were taking place. But on the Israeli system, they had what they call the concepcia. And the concepcia at that time is that Egypt would never seek to cross the Suez Canal because they couldn't win that fight, that they would never take such a gamble. So therefore, everything they're seeing that suggests Egypt is preparing to cross the Suez Canal is dismissed because it doesn't fit the concepcia of the Israeli leadership. Well, it turns out the concepcia was 100% wrong, and Egypt did go across the border. And from that point on, Israel created a whole different approach to intelligence. To eliminate the concepcia, they created a position called the Doubting Thomas, a very senior colonel, and all assessments that would be produced that would make their way up to senior decision making had to go through the Doubting Thomas. And if the Doubting Thomas asked a question or, you know, asked for clarification, it had to be addressed to his satisfaction before it could go up. No senior leader would read an assessment that hadn't gone through the Doubting Thomas. And so this helped create a situation, for instance, where Israel in 1994 made a decision to move away from a decision that had been made in 1991 to assassinate Saddam Hussein and instead work with weapons inspectors to seek to reduce the threat from Iraq by eliminating weapons of mass destruction under United Nations supervision. Israel was able to make this shift because they weren't married to a conception. They started to go to, you know, fact-based analysis. And this worked through, you know, Yuri Sagay, and then I forget the and Alon, I can't remember who replaced him. I met him several times, but I can't remember his name right now. Went on to be a very senior Israeli, a chief of staff, I believe. But he was, you know, the head of Amman in the end when I left was a guy named Amos Gilad. And Amos Gilad was more of an ideologue. And he's the one who moved away from the Doubting Thomas and reintroduced the Concepcion. Under Amos Gilad, Israel walked away from the fact-based assertions and assessments that it made in 1998 that Iraq was largely disarmed and posed no threat, to by 2001 saying Iraq had reconstituted its weapons of mass destruction program and they, you know, they had to be invaded so Saddam could be eliminated. Again, they went back to saying Saddam has to go. The Concepcion was back, and from that moment on, Israeli intelligence became horrifically politicized. You know, and so now what you have is a situation where Israeli intelligence has bought into a model called the Nasrallah model. That is, if we just bomb them and kill their leadership, and then we attack them from senior and intermediate layers of leadership, you'll get a collapse, is what they think they saw with Hezbollah. And so it's the Nasrallah model that was applied on day one of the of this conflict. They admit it now. They tried to kill Ali Khamenei. They were hunting. They tried to kill him the first night, and they were hunting for him throughout. They just couldn't get eyes on target. But they did kill senior and intermediate level leadership. This was their goal. Their conception is that if they can eliminate this leadership, the system will collapse from within. And the United States has bought into this conception, this Israeli model. And so I think that's where we're at right now, where the United States and Israel are operating under this fundamentally flawed notion of that if you just take out certain elements, the whole system collapses. But what you don't get in the United States is an appreciation for a couple things. One, the role played by democracy in Iran. This isn't a dictatorship. This isn't Saddam Hussein or Bashar al-Assad. It's not the dictatorship of the supreme jurisprudent, the supreme leader. The supreme leader has a very important role to play, But even the supreme leader is bound by the Constitution and bound by, the supreme leader can be impeached, even though he's the supreme leader. The assembly of experts can remove him. And should the supreme leader act in a way that is in contravention to the will of the people, the parliament, the president, the guardian council, expediency council, if the supreme leader moves in a direction, then he can be and will be replaced. The supreme leader is a position, not a person. So even though you have a name to that position right now, Ali Khamenei, you know, he's 90 plus years old. The Assembly of Experts has already picked his replacement. They know who it's going to be. And if you kill Ali Khamenei, they have that. And as soon as they pick a new one, it's their job to pick a new one. The Assembly of Experts is constitutionally required to have a list of candidates available to replace the Supreme Leader. So the idea that you're going to kill
Ali Khamenei. They have 3 to 5 people correct. Waiting for that.
Yeah. Correct. They've got a list. The system works in Iraq. It's in Iran. It's not a perfect system. No system is. But this is a system that functions and has functioned successfully for many decades now. This isn't a young dictatorship or something of that nature. This is a system that has gone through the test of time, trials and tribulations. It's been stress tested before. We have seen a declining participation rate in the national elections, and that is something that worries the supreme leadership. But I would imagine that if you had an election soon, that you would have high participation rates because people are starting to realize how important it is to be sovereign, how weakened Iran becomes when they look to outside powers, how they cannot trust the outside powers. The fatal mistake of the West has been to allow itself to be denigrated inside Iran. To me, the fatal weakness of Iran was this desire to be part of the West, this desire to belong with the West. And the West has never given Iran a chance to be a part. Had they done so, we might be having a different discussion right now, because I truly believe that it would have been a big challenge for the Islamic Republic to survive a West that was willing to receive Iran and work with Iran, and that it would lead to, you know, changes that were too rapid for the system to. Who knows? I'm just saying things that we'll never know, because it's the same way that the West screwed up in Russia. The best way to bring down Vladimir Putin wasn't to go to war against Vladimir Putin, but was to take advantage of the level to which the West had infiltrated Russia in the 1990s and continue to keep that door open, and try to outcompete Russia for, you know, values and things like that. That would, you know, but we did them the greatest favor by sanctioning them. Russia shut the door, and now Russia's totally solidified its position. They're not going to let the West back in. We've made that mistake with Iran. The West will not be allowed back in. This is it. And I think the Iranian regime is very resilient, and can withstand this. They'll definitely outlast Trump. I believe that the idea that the Iranian regime is going to collapse because of what anything Donald Trump has done. You know, the worst Donald Trump could do is get America involved in a long-term conflict with Iran. But that will create political problems, be devastating to the economy, et cetera. If they want to play the wait and see game, sanctions, things of that nature, it'll outlast Trump. And, you know, remember, we have to recognize that the United States is a power in transition right now, away from being the global hegemon to being, you know, one of many multipolar. We're seeing the rise of Russia and China and their influence. I don't think Iran is going to allow to be isolated like Iraq and Syria were. I think you're going to see Iran actually be integrated into this massive community called BRICS. And as a result, Iran will be able to outlast, you know, both Israel and the United States. And neither Israel nor the United States is in a big hurry to go to war with Iran, because for Trump, it would be politically devastating. And for Israel, they got hurt. I mean, you know, they're right now going to the doctors, getting x-rays, and he's saying, well, he broke all your ribs, he bruised your kidneys, you're hurt. You don't want to get back in the ring. So I think this regime change fantasy will fail, but I do believe that both Israel and the United States are using what I call the inspection trap model, a modification of Nasrallah model and the Saddam model and the Assad model.
What I found somehow similar to what has happened to Russia, these people who are in Iran, who are part of the government, who are part of high-ranked people like Javad Zarif, the ex-prime minister, the ex-foreign minister of Iran, and former prime minister of Iran, he and his people and the people like him, they wanted to be part of the West. They wanted to have a better relation with the West. We had the same sort of issue, with the same sort of attitude on the part of Russia. They wanted to be part of the West. They wanted to be closer to the United States, to Europe. But anytime they try to do that, it seems somehow in the West they've been perceived as weak, as getting weaker. That's why they're pursuing, they want to be connected with the West. But after all, you look at what has happened to Ukraine in the war with Russia. What I see right now in Russia, in my opinion, Vladimir Putin is trying to negotiate with the United States because he wants to get rid of what's going on in Ukraine as soon as possible. He doesn't care about the future because he doesn't see a future with the United States. It seems that the same thing is happening when I follow the Iranian media inside the country, and the way that they criticizing these people like Javad Zarif and these people, they're getting weaker inside the country. And for those people who are concerned about the great fight between the United States and China, so why are not, why you're making these people in Iran, in Russia, weaker than before? Why you're putting them in a corner that they're not going to be in charge? They're not going to have any sort of power to talk about having a better relationship with the West. And how do you find this? How do you find the level of understanding, the level of the mutual understanding between the United States and these two countries, Iran and Russia?
Well, it's, since you brought up the Russian model, let's expand upon that first. You know, the fact of the matter is the United States has not had, you know, genuine Russian experts for some time now. You know, we have a class of people who came into academic and political prominence in the 1990s. Michael McFaul is a notable example of this. People whose opinion of Russia was shaped not by the former Soviet Union, but by the collapse of the Soviet Union in the decade of the 90s, when Russia was a failed nation lying prostrate at the feet of the West, and the West was exploiting them. And the resentment that then exists amongst this class when Putin stood on his feet and said, no, we refuse to be exploited. You know, the Russian reset that Barack Obama undertook, I think in 2009, was not about resetting relations. It was regime change. It was about keeping Vladimir Putin out of power. You know, Putin, just so people realize, you know, constitutionally could have two consecutive terms, but the Constitution didn't say what happens if he gaps a term and then, you know, the clock resets. And so he swapped out with Dmitry Medvedev, who was prime minister and now became president, and Putin became prime minister. And the goal of the reset was to keep Medvedev in office and keep Putin out of office. That's the regime change they wanted, because they felt that Medvedev was more open to reforms and, you know, and more open to keeping the U.S., you know, and the West entrenched in Russia. It failed miserably. And Putin came back. And if you notice, one of the first things Putin did when he became president the third time was to ban, you know, Western NGOs and all these vectors into Russian society that the West was trying to exploit under Medvedev's, you know, term as president. But let's look at Dmitry Medvedev. Here's a man who the West said, you know, we can do business with because he's not as, you know, anti-Western is Putin, that he's somebody who has a different approach. Today, he's a rabid dog. I mean, read his tweets there, you know. And I don't know what the future is going to hold, but I would say that in Iran, it's the same problem. We don't have genuine Iranian experts. We have people like Kenneth Pollack and others who have made a living off of just making things up about Iran, just like other people make things up about Russia. Academia has been hijacked by people who aren't bound by the reality of what Iran is today, but by the perception of Iran that's promoted by a diaspora that wants the, you know, the theocracy removed and the Shah to come back. And so they don't promote, you know, what's really going on. They promote this fiction, this fantasy. And so we don't understand what's happening inside Iran, just like we never understood what was happening inside Russia. Zarif, you know, I've met him. He is very oriented towards the West. He is a Western, but he's also an Iranian patriot. And I think people should never forget that Zarif will never sell his nation to the West. And I will put, you know, if we could gamble on things, I'd put money on Zarif becoming a Medvedev type figure down the road, meaning that you know, he is not going to betray Iran. And the more he, you know, he's like a jilted, God, I don't want to say this to get him in trouble, but, you know, a jilted lover, you know, who says, you know, I was betrayed by somebody who I gave my heart to, and bam, there's no hate like the hate that comes from a jilted lover. And there's not, you know, look at Medvedev. He has turned on the West. He is not sympathetic, a fan of the West at all, because he's been used by the West. Literally, he was used. He was lied to by Barack Obama, straight up lied about New START and ballistic missile treaties and defenses and NATO expansion, because they viewed him as weak. And the West, you know, they don't respect Zarif. They view him as weak. They view him as culpable, pliable, exploitable. And once Zarif realizes that that's how the West treats him and viewed him and everybody else of his ilk, you know, they're not going to go crawling to the West saying, oh, I want to be part of you. You know, they're going to, because they're Iranian patriots, and they're going to say, okay, well, then the hell with you. You know, and you'll see they'll become even more hardline than the hardliners, because there's, you know, they know the truth. They have experienced the letdown. And I think that's what's going to happen in Iran. I don't think there's going to be this class of, you know, pro-Western people, you know, working with the West to bring down Iranian society from within. I think it's just the opposite. People who wanted to work with the West now being awakened to the reality of the West, and they'll rally around the theocracy and the regime, but more importantly, they'll rally around the Iranian people in the nation of Iran. And that's the way I see this going.